This is Squawk Pod. I'm CNBC producer Katie Kramer. Today on our podcast, airlines seeking over $50 billion in government assistance, three times the size of their bailouts after 9/11. Aerospace analyst Seth Kaplan.
This is an industry that thought it had put itself in a position to get through absolutely anything, and, you know, it probably was in a position to get through absolutely anything except this.
Mark Cuban says the U.S. government has taken risk out of the equation, but bailouts are needed for workers.
When you're really blessed like I am, the value of one marginal dollar becomes minimal. It's not just about how much more money I can make, but what other types of impact can I have?
And the latest on staying safe with Dr. Scott Gottlieb, former FDA chief.
We're certainly having an impact on the scope of this epidemic and the contours of this epidemic.
It's Wednesday, March 18th, 2020. Squawk Pod begins right now.
Stand Becky by in 3, 2, 1, cue, please.
Good morning, everybody. Welcome to Squawk Box here on CNBC. We are coming to you live from all over the place today. I'm Becky Quick, along with Andrew Ross Sorkin and Joe Kernan. And again, we are making sure we continue to broadcast to you through this pandemic that we are watching at this point.
First up on today's pod, the U.S. government's plan for economic stimulus. The Federal Reserve has announced measures that it's taking. We've discussed that here on Squawk Pod. Now, the U.S. Treasury Secretary Steven Mnuchin has pitched a $1 trillion package to Senate Republicans. Now, this plan includes sending Americans checks to help households and businesses stay afloat. The Trump administration has backed it, but other Republicans are split. Here's Andrew.
Ultimately, what's going to happen is you're already seeing the Elizabeth Warrens and others say, you know, if we're going to give money, we need to clamp down on executive compensation. We need to have these stipulations and these stipulations. Frankly, what needs to happen, and I think from chronicling the 2008 crisis and every other crisis, is you just need massive stimulus. You actually don't want strings attached because you want as many people to take the stimulus as humanly possible,
yes.
Which is antithetical.
Yes,
Joe,
but
politically,
you want this,
on the other end
this,
of where you typically
you want
be.
This to happen. Andrew, you want this to happen as quickly as possible, but you probably want it to be more targeted. You start thinking about how to hand that much money away. And, you know, look, it needs to go to the people who have lost their jobs, who have been put out of work, and from the small business owners who are in that position of already having laid them off. I saw a letter this morning from a guy I'm hoping we're going to have on the show tomorrow. He's a restaurateur. He's based in Ohio, but he's got restaurants, I think, in, 37 restaurants in 14 states. On Monday, he laid off 4,000 employees. He's saying that it would basically take him at least 2 weeks of revenue to get all those places back up and running because he has to bring in managers and staff ahead of time to get the restaurants clean, to get everything back up and running. I mean, I don't need money. You don't need money right now. Joe doesn't need money right now. No. I'd like to see that money go to the people who need it. I talked to an accountant yesterday in New Jersey who says that he's got about 20 clients that just this week have had to lay off 50% or more of their staff. He was talking about cancellations of business that's been booked out of the next 2 months and no new business coming in. These are people like caterers, limo service providers, moving companies, tree service providers. He said they're all dead in the water. And that's where the immediate incredible shock has come across this country. And that's where the money needs to be
going. And we're definitely having different hats shifting around. I saw AOC yesterday. AOC yesterday said something about, wait a second, Boeing had $38 billion in buybacks over the last however many years. Now we're talking about a $60 billion bailout for the industry. And I found myself going, definitely there's some political
nobody was saving anything for a rainy
day. I agree with that. That here you blew all this money up at $300 and $400 a share.
Yeah.
Now
but,
you're down.
But the damage
and now
is
you
too great.
It,
but, Joe, let me just suggest that ultimately, whatever stimulus
is. Tell me how it is, Andrew?
No, I'm just going to suggest that whatever stimulus program we're going to have is ultimately going to privatize the gains and socialize the losses. That's what happens in a crisis. But when the crisis is over, there needs to be a real discussion about financial responsibility in this country, which we don't have in the best of times. To actually have insurance policies and money on hand when these things happen. And that's the problem
here. Boeing employs 100,000 people.
Because to use the crisis to change the policy in the moment is too painful. The problem is that nobody's willing to use to use the good times to change the policy. And we've had that debate too many times.
Andrew, I was thinking yesterday, Andrew? I agree with you. I agree with you. But I think that we got to look at all this ESG stakeholder stuff that we went through and realize, holy cow, we need profits to do all these great things.
We do.
We need profits to share with our stakeholders. And if you blow all this money on some CEO's pet projects for virtue signaling, and then you come to a time like this, you realize, wow, shareholders really do need to have profits to share with, to satisfy any other stakeholders, you need to be profitable and not planting trees in Africa.
Boeing will be asking for tens of billions of dollars in government aid. This coming as Treasury Secretary Steven Mnuchin called this crisis, quote, worse than 9/11 for the airline industry. Joining us right now to talk about it is Seth Kaplan, principal at Kaplan Research. Good morning to you, Seth. Let's talk about the need for these bailouts, what happens to these airlines. Greg Ip suggested that unemployment in this country just on travel alone would go from 3.5% to 6%.
Right, that just the travel-related job losses would drive the overall employment rate up to 6%. This, as everybody has said, is worse than 9/11 in a lot of ways. And we do have to sort of try to put ourselves back in that mindset. It's easy now to say, well, the thing about 9/11 is that awful first day was the worst day, and then there was recovery. We know that now. We didn't know that when we were in the middle of that. Remarkable that these airlines, you know, 9/11 happened on a Tuesday. By that Saturday, they were laying off tens of thousands of people. 75,000 U.S. airline jobs were gone within a few weeks. This time, these giant airlines haven't laid off anybody in terms of direct employees yet. So that speaks to the position they were in going into this thing. But obviously, throw out the window.
Seth, what's the run rate? Can you just speak to the run rate in terms of employment costs? If the goal is to keep people employed, to keep people on payrolls across the country, and this is in all businesses, but specifically in the airline business, where we could just take a Delta or an American Airlines as an example.
To pay people to stay at home, frankly, to do nothing.
Yes.
So for the U.S. industry, I'm just trying to do quick math. Delta does a $6 billion profit on $40 billion in revenue and something. I mean, it's up for the industry. I mean, $60, $70, $80 billion or something if you're just paying salaries
annually
for the U.S. Yeah, I mean, that's very, very, very bad. But anyway, it's not $5 billion and it's not $500 billion. I mean, that's just, you know, very, very roughly. Yeah. So that's, you know, and that might be part of the grand bargain here. And that might be part of why. I mean, at some point, look, people running airlines have this fiduciary responsibility to everybody to save the company. But in terms of why they are still paying people to do nothing, that might be the leverage here, because they know there are people out there saying, you know, this industry earned tens of billions of dollars in profits last year.
This becomes the question. Long term, if there is a targeted bailout, and this goes to whether you want to do a targeted bailout or a nationwide bailout. If you do a targeted bailout at the airline industry, by default, you're going to determine their common carriers. That's what's going to happen, right?
Yeah.
And therefore, you're going to have to put some forms of other regulation on them. Forget about buybacks. It's going to be about building this remarkable insurance cushion over the years, and it would change the entire dynamic of the industry. I'm not suggesting that's the wrong thing to do. I just suggest that's the political thing, if this is the path they're going to go down.
Especially because, I mean, as Greg was talking earlier about how this just impacts absolutely everybody. I mean, this is, you know, the idea of too big to fail. The problem is that it's not a redistribution anymore, right? Because everybody's in the same situation. So if we're going to say that this industry is special, even though, you know, the guy at the Greek deli in my neighborhood is feeling it just as badly, it's reasonable to say. And you've got the unions saying that, of course, unions representing flight attendants, pilots, and others that should be tied to it. Right now,
Delta is worth something on the order of $20 billion. Does that make sense to you? Is that a bet that investors are going to be bailed out by taxpayers? Is that what's happening here?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's baked in. All the usual granular stuff. Obviously, nobody could look at now. But no, I mean, I think at this point, you know, we know what the airlines have asked for: $50 billion, you know, $25 billion in grants, $25 billion in loans. And yeah, I mean, I think at this point, that's the expectation. that
hey, Seth, hang on. We got Becky who's got a question for you.
Hey, Becky.
Hey, if that's baked in, how come you're looking at some of those airlines down by another 10% this morning? My guess is investors are thinking, okay, the industry may get bailed out, but we're not sure what that means for shareholders yet.
For shareholders, no, exactly. And you know, you've heard those calls out there that for shareholders to somehow get diluted by all this. But no, exactly. That's fair point. That's two separate questions. You know, jobs, and is there still something called American Airlines versus what does that mean for shareholders?
And therefore, the question I'd ask you, Seth, is if you're an investor out there today who actually owns these airline stocks, what are you even supposed to think?
Well, yeah. And
some people say there's an opportunity that you should buy the stocks and bet that the government's going to save you and protect the shareholders. And others might say you need to get rid of this immediately because they're effectively nationalize the airlines when everything's done and you're going to lose everything.
Yeah. I'm trying to think of baby bathwater, what the right analogy is there. You know, I think the industry legitimately reformed itself enough that's probably not what's going to happen here. Obviously, if you are still holding shares of these airlines, that's your bet that the industry is not going to be nationalized or something like that, that this is going to be, you know, like the banks, just like, you know, what happened there with the ratios and everything, that this is an industry that thought it had put itself in a position to get through absolutely anything. And, you know, and it probably was in a position to get through absolutely anything except this. Right. So that's your bet. I think if you're holding these now is that, yeah, it's going to look different. But the equity's obviously not going to get wiped out.
Hey, Seth, thank you, as always, and stay safe. Meantime, NBA team owners were some of the first people to pledge support for their arena workers as the coronavirus hit U.S. shores. Now, Dallas Mavericks owner Mark Cuban says if companies are bailed out, all employees should have the chance to benefit from a possible turnaround in the form of stock compensation. Mark Cuban joins us now on the phone. Good morning to you, Mark.
Good morning.
We've been through these bailouts before, and there have been a lot of political finger pointing afterwards. You have a thought about how this should be done.
Yeah, we already know what's going to happen. You know, a year after this, you know, plays out, and it will, we'll look back and say, why didn't we, you know, consider the workers, the everyday hourly worker, the people, you know, making minimum wage? Why didn't we reward them as well? And so let's get ahead of it. And whatever we do in a bailout, make sure that every worker gets compensated and is treated equally, and that the executives don't get rewarded extra to stick around because they got nowhere else to go. You know, the government's taking their risk out of the equation. Let's treat all workers equally.
So, but how would we do that? Because one of the things that, you know, look, there's going to be all sorts of stimulus plans, bailouts and the like. And one of the things you want to do is get that money into the system as quickly as possible. You don't want people not to take the money. And so the more strings that you attach to it, and I'm not suggesting you don't, but the more that you do, the more likely it is that certain people may hold back. And so I'm trying to figure out how to capture that balance.
Okay. Two different things. One, getting money into the system is a function of the Fed, and they're obviously taking those steps right now. Two is when there's a bailout. When there's a bailout and the government comes in and offers assistance to an organization, a public company in particular, whether it's an airline, whatever it may be, there are most likely going to be steps taken by the company, and historically this is what has taken place, where they reward the executives. Mm-hmm. They reprice their options. They give them more stock. They give them warrants. They give them options, whatever it may be. Whatever it is that a company does for their executives, they should be required to proportionally do the same thing for everyone else that works for the company. Period, end of story, part one. Part two, no buybacks. Not now. Not a year from now, not 20 years from now, not ever, because effectively you're spending taxpayer money to buy back stock. And to me, that's just the wrong way to do that.
Do you think that we're going to have a national bailout for companies across the board? Do you think we should look to airlines or other specific industries for help? I mean, that we should be helping? How would you approach it?
I think we have to. I mean, look, this is cascading, and it's getting worse by the minute. The number of layoffs is just skyrocketing. And so if I walked in the door first thing I would do is prioritize. And I would create effectively, and this isn't the right word, but effectively create two buckets. Bucket number one, and we have to do these things in parallel. Bucket number one is how do you help companies of all sizes to keep paying their employees and not lay them off or fire them? Because we want to keep people employed. Even if it's make good work, even if this is the Tennessee Valley Authority all over again, and we're just subsidizing companies to keep their employees on the payroll and finding things for them to do. Because keeping them in the payroll, it will pay off more in terms of minimizing taxpayer requirements than releasing them or firing them or laying them off and then having to go find jobs in the future. So that's bucket number one. Do all you can to keep people employed. Bucket number two, we've already seen significant layoffs. There are people who are already unemployed. That's where we might consider helping people, whereas if you're going on to unemployment or any type of government, federal government assistance, then maybe we pay them a bonus, and that's not a good word for this, but give them a check for the $1,000 to help them get through the immediate need because they've just been laid off or they don't have a job. And that helps people get through these problem times. But they should be just two very distinct buckets. But the priority has got to be working to help people stay employed. I actually don't like the idea of just giving everybody a $1,000 check, because for a lot of small businesses, you know, if they know that their employees are going to get a check and that business is struggling, they might say, you know what, I'm going to lay them off or fire them because I know they have a backstop of some sort. And when this is hopefully all over in 3 or 4 months, like people are predicting, we'll figure it out then. That creates a far greater stress on the system. So I really think that the priority needs to be, one, keep people employed, and two, those who have lost their job. You know, we've seen the entertainment industry, we've seen the hospitality industry, the airline industry, the transportation industry is all decimated. And where there have been layoffs, I don't have a problem with those people who, as they get onto federal assistance, giving them a check up front to help support them and the economy. But we've got to deal with both. And I think the priority needs to be on helping people keep their jobs.
Okay. Mark, hang on for a second. I want to see if we can bring Joe into the conversation. Sure. Joe, you there?
Sure. Hey, Joe.
Hey, Mark. How are you? Nobody likes any of this stuff. But I mean, all bets are off, aren't they? I mean, these are... Anytime we think, you know, we don't want to do this, do we need to talk about moral hazard when you're talking about a deadly virus? I don't know. It seems like any other time, I understand, but go ahead.
I agree, Joe. Perfection is the enemy of progress. You know, in normal times, you want to look at all the distribution of outcomes and try to do the best thing that helps the most number of people. But this is a new world, literally. This is the new normal. And we have to just look at what's in front of us and deal with it. You know, and yes, there's going to be people who scam the system, but you can't hurt the people who need it and risk supporting the economy and what the tragic things that could happen there, because you're trying to avoid some people scamming the system. But you do bring up a good point in terms of moral hazard. What we can do is increase the penalties. And so, like, you know, when we went through the financial crisis, you know, people talk about how no one went to jail. Well, as part of all of this, you know, whether it's a bailout, whether it's a $1,000 check for those who have lost their jobs, we should add, if you try to scam the system in any way, shape, or form, there is jail as your penalty, because we want to introduce a moral hazard. I'm not talking about, you know, something ridiculously draconian, but still, there should be something. It shouldn't be a civil issue. It should be fully a criminal issue, and everybody should know that going in.
Yeah, and Mark, I just, if we have to decide what kind of snapback we're going to get when we do get through this, and you know, I pray that it's sooner rather than later, how psyched Amen. Are you going to be to sit on the side? I mean, did you appreciate it enough when you're sitting there? I'm jonesing on DraftKings. I'm like, I'm going to bet on, like, esports, but I don't think you can do that either. But, I mean, missing the Final Four,
can,
I mean, that's going to snap back.
You know, we all use sports as a way to celebrate, the way to get excited, the way to come together. Nobody throws a parade when Apple or Google will have the most amazing quarter they've ever had. But when a team wins a championship, they throw a parade. And so hopefully we'll have the Olympics and we'll be able to come together as a country around our team, our, you know, the U.S. Olympics team. And that'll be great for us. We'll all get out of the house. We'll all celebrate together. Hopefully when the NBA, the NHL, Major League Soccer, Major League Baseball, football all start to really happen again, we'll all get excited about our teams, and as communities, we'll come together. Sports will be a vital mechanism for bringing people back together when this happens. And so, yeah, I'm excited for that, but in reality, basketball is the last thing on my mind right now. But I will say we're using the Mavericks to try to do as much as we can to keep people energized and engaged while everybody's stuck at home.
Hey, Mark, it's good to talk to you. I saw your reaction. I think we all did. The cameras were on you when you were on the sidelines of the game to find out that the NBA was shutting things down. Your reaction, I think, at that point was something like, are you kidding me? Or something along those lines, maybe.
Yeah,
you changed your tune really quickly. To kind of walk us through your emotional, the hill you kind of climbed and fell back off of the other side.
Yeah, I mean, we had considered all the potential options, the Mavs management, and really what really ignited my response was prior to the game, I met with the players, and one of the players said, what are the chances the season gets suspended or postponed? And I said 5-10% at most. And, you know, I'd considered it, but I really didn't consider it likely based on the information we had at that time. And then when it came across that Rudy Gobert had been sick and the one game had been canceled and the season had been canceled, I was just stunned. And, you know, then my mind started thinking, you know, the entrepreneur in me took over. Okay, what are the elements that I need to consider going forward? You know, what are my responsibilities? You know, who's going to be helped? You know, what are the opportunities and who's going to get hurt? And this was so drastic and so outside the realm of anything I really considered likely that's when I started thinking about, okay, who's going to get hurt the most and what can I do and how can we make sure that everybody lands on their feet? Because, you know, let me just say this, you know, when you're really blessed like I am, the value of one marginal dollar becomes minimal. And so I've gotten to the point in my life where it's not just about how much more money I can make, but what other types of impact can I have? And so that literally was one of the first things that crossed my mind. What can I do to try to help people and try to make it better? And starting with the Mavs employees, arena employees, that was my focus. And so, you know, so when I did that interview, that's what I was thinking about. And then obviously my family and my mom, who's 82, and other people, like, what happens next? Because it was complete uncertainty then.
You invest in the markets.
Yes.
What are you thinking? What would you do?
You know, I've been putting in, you know, 1-1.5% to work on every down day, buying mostly SPYs and dipping my toes. I bought a little Live Nation. I actually sold some puts and sold some calls on some things I had because just the premiums are just incredible. I mean, it's stunning the premiums that are in place right now. But it looks like we're starting to get into a trading range. You know, up 5%, down 5%, up 5%, down 5%. And I'm not quite sure why. And I'm not quite sure if the quants have kicked back in yet and feel like they have good data to start making a lot of trades. And so, you know, it felt like for a while we had active management doing all the work and try to figure things out. And now over the last 3 days, it feels like we're starting to get more algorithmic trading coming into the market. And now today, based off of the, you know, being up yesterday and being down about the same today, it looks like we may be starting to fall into a range. So, you know, I'll act accordingly, but it's just every day. This is just like, how much information can you acquire and what new is coming along and how does that change things? So I'm like everybody else.
Okay.
You know, I'll dip my toe in the water, hoping that 2 years from now, you know, this will all be a nightmare that we put behind us and the market will be much higher.
Let's hope you're right. Mark Cuban, thank you so very much. And please stay safe
and healthy.
And
thanks for keeping on working. I mean, it's good. It gives us all a sense of normalcy when we're stuck at home and we get to turn Squawk Box on and CNBC all day long, for that matter. Makes us feel a little better.
Thank you, Mark, so very, very much. Really appreciate it.
Coming up on Squawk Pod, more ways to curb the spread of coronavirus. Dr. Scott Gottlieb, Squawk regular and former head of the FDA, you hear from him a lot, suggests there could be more to come.
Do we require people to wear not N95 masks, which are in short supply, but procedure masks?
If we know there's asymptomatic spread or mildly symptomatic young people spreading this virus.
We'll be right back. This is Squawk Pod from CNBC. Here's Andrew Ross Sorkin.
Up and Andrew, cue.
Worldwide, coronavirus infections have now topped 200,000. Almost 6,500 cases have been confirmed in the United States, nearly 2,000 more than at this time just yesterday. 114 people here have died. In his latest op-ed in the Wall Street Journal, CNBC contributor Dr. Scott Gottlieb talks about the capacity of the U.S. hospitals and how there still could be time to flatten the curve of the rising number of cases. Dr. Gottlieb joins us now on the phone. He's also the former FDA commissioner, of course, and serves on the boards of Pfizer and Illumina. And we are always grateful to have his expertise with us. Good morning to you, doctor. Let's talk about flattening the curve for a second, because there have been lots of steps that have now been taken over the past several days across this country and in this state and city where we are right now in New York. And as people are trying to look at the timeline of what this may or may not be, the president, of course, mentioned July and August recently. Investors are trying to figure out what this timeline looks like. Of course, the timeline gets extended out the better we do in terms of flattening the curve to some degree. What are you seeing in terms of estimates and how that flattening is changing, or is it?
Well, thanks for having me this morning. We're certainly having an impact on the scope of this epidemic and the contours of this epidemic and how many cases we're going to get at the peak and how long it's going to last. The steps we've taken in the last 2 weeks are very aggressive. I think I'm heartened by what the mayors and the governors have been willing to do. These are strong actions. I think the president's reference was probably to the analysis that's circulating in Washington and the White House. It shows this peaking out late April, early May. Remember, if you peak in April, in the end of April, 7 weeks from now, you still continue to accrue cases for another 7 weeks. That's just the peak. It comes down. So that analysis would show this epidemic continuing the course into late June, and that gets you into July. So I think that might have been what he was referring to. I'm not sure.
Doctor, can you just, on that peak issue, though, so let's say we're in a late April, early May situation. It gets extended out through the end of June, and maybe that's the way businesses should think about this, investors should think about it. If that's the case, though, the social distancing steps and everything else that we're taking today, in your mind, they need to last through the end of June? I mean, I'm trying to understand if people look at the peak, and because people look at what took place in China and elsewhere, and after it started to peak out, as you know, at least in China, some people started to go back to work, and you started to see an increase of business again. Is that the right way to think about it, or not so much?
I think it's going to be very hard to take our foot off the brake if we're still accruing cases. And that's why I think a lot of the school closures are going to be in perpetuity. Probably the school year is lost for a lot of these districts where there is community transmission, because you don't want to lift the restrictions too quickly and then have another resurgence in cases. But you can lift them and then put in place other measures. And so, for example, you know, one of the things we might contemplate is, do we require people to wear not N95 masks, which are in short supply, but procedure masks? If we know there's asymptomatic spread or mildly symptomatic young people spreading this virus, the procedure masks aren't in short supply. It's the N95 masks that the healthcare workers need. So there might be other things we can substitute in that could provide some protection as transmission slows down and the risk isn't as great.
Doctor, in terms of, I mean, we've been talking to you literally daily, and so trying to understand the progress that's being made one way or the other. You know, if you look at what's taking place in Italy, the numbers continue to ramp. How much should the United States take away from that experience relative to the experience of South Korea? I think one of the other things that investors and, frankly, policymakers are trying to do is look at these different models, and it's very hard to ascertain why certain things are happening in certain regions.
Well, I think what South Korea did was very aggressive testing right at the outset and an effort to contain and isolate people. They tested 1 in 200 people in South Korea, and they even tested, you know, young people. Right now in the U.S., even though we have more testing capability in terms of platforms, we're still not able to test everyone. Certain people are being told to just stay at home and assume you have coronavirus. The problem with that is that if you don't have a positive test result, you're probably less likely to self-isolate and take it seriously, and you also can't enforce the quarantine without a positive test result in most cases. So testing people and telling them they have it could be very helpful. In Italy, there were a couple of things that went wrong. Number one, people showed up at the hospitals when they were sick, and they spread the virus in the hospitalized setting. It's an older population. There's higher smoking rates. So there's reasons why Italy, the background in Italy, was more conducive to a bad outcome relative to what our experience could be if we do the right things.
Okay. Dr. Gottlieb, it's always good to speak with you, and please stay safe out there, and I'm sure we'll be talking to you a lot
later
this week. You bet.
And that's Squawk Pod for today. Thank you for listening. Squawk Box is hosted by Joe Kernan, Becky Quick, and Andrew Ross Sorkin, together in spirit, if keeping social distance. Please continue to tune in weekday mornings on CNBC at 6 a.m. Eastern. To get the smartest takes and analysis from our TV show right into your ears, subscribe to Squawk Pod. We're on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Spotify. Wherever you are listening these days, we are working so hard to be there. So stick with us, and we'll meet you back here tomorrow.
We are clear. Thanks, guys.